Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. It is a very special episode, and I'm so happy that you guys have joined us. My name is Fernando Arencibia, and with me, as always, is a person that has a very fine ear for deals, for great conversation, for great wine, and even better, dark chocolate. Jennifer Wollman. Jennifer, say hello.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our first episode of 2025. I hope everybody had a wonderful holiday season and is looking forward to all the opportunities that 2025 will bring. And so as such, we had to make this a special episode, and we are so excited to start off the new year with an interview with Enrique Terán. Enrique is a serial entrepreneur. He is the co-founder and CEO of Avantiway Companies, a vertically integrated real estate company that includes brokerage services, property and asset management, development, title, mortgage, debt, and probably a couple more that I don't even know about. And full disclosure, Enrique is also one of Fernando's and my partners at Avantiway Commercial. In addition to being a serial entrepreneur, he is a great guy, a forward thinker, a mover and shaker, and somebody who gets things done. So today we wanted to focus on the capital arm and financing, you know, identifying opportunities, financing the deal, raising capital, etc., because we do believe there's a lot of opportunities in today's commercial real estate market. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. And happy new year to everybody out there. Hopefully everybody has their plans for this upcoming year done already and they're beginning to execute them, right?
Yes, for sure. Definitely. So Enrique, you're an engineer. How did you end up in real estate?
So my family had a brokerage firm back in the 1980s. My family comes from Nicaragua. We exiled over here in 1979, the year I was born. And actually my family represented General Electric in Nicaragua. And essentially, General Electric was building a huge project, Fontainebleau by FIU, right? And my parents got their hands on that project and helped them sell it. And that was kind of our intro into the real estate world. And essentially, they grew a nice-sized little firm. It wasn't anything big. It was very specialized in dealing with Central and South American investors and doing property management and whatnot. And then ultimately in 2000, the opportunity for me to come into the business came about. Essentially, my parents separated and I felt the need to help my mom shape up the real estate business. And the next thing you know, based on my engineering background, I fell in love with the industry. I saw many, many opportunities, many things that we could do. And essentially, you know, went all in and now built everything that I've built, you know, within the industry.
Great. So tell us a little bit about the capital side, the debt side, how you go about identifying a deal, or more importantly, once you identify it, how do you put the deal together? When I first started in real estate and real estate investing, I thought I needed either one, to have all the money up front, or that I had to get the loan on my own. And it wasn't until later that I found out all the different opportunities available for financing the deal.
So I would add to that how I fell into capital, right? I think that's an interesting storyline, and then how we kind of learned how to do all the things in capital. So I have very little commercial background, accounting background, and financial background. But essentially what I ended up doing was selling to several investors in 2008 after I learned how to sell and rent properties. And essentially from there, I began managing their properties. And what I realized over time was the amount of returns I was making them. Because I had control of the accounting and I can see clearly what was coming in, I started understanding how these investments would perform, right? And understanding that you would build an immense amount of wealth for your investors. And as the real estate agent, you're typically getting the bits and pieces, if you will, right? You get a little commission here and it's very little off what you make the investor. So I thought there was something wrong with that picture, because if the realtor is truly finding such an amazing deal, they should be able to capitalize on it. And I began doing my research. I began trying to analyze the behavior of an investor. What is the psychology behind the investment? And I found myself with a huge opportunity, because I noticed, Jennifer and Fernando, that the industry was listening to what the investor wanted, which was, I don't want to deal with the headache of the tenant. I don't want to deal with the headache of the place. And what they were really, really looking for and what they needed was a return on investment. It was performing their money was the number one objective. But now in the industry, when we dove into it, there was no software, there's no technology that's financially analyzing a real estate investment. So we set ourselves out to develop it. We developed it ground up. We set up our accounting stack. Then we put our financial stack on top of that, the property management stack as well. And everything started coming together in a way where we were able to now visualize and understand the returns the investors were getting. So essentially, we finished developing the software and we had now visibility of how we were really performing for the investors. And the investors started seeing their returns live. And that started creating a movement where the investor wanted to invest more money. Obviously, they were seeing the clarity of their returns. Now, I was predominantly in residential and I was selling residential units, single family. I had never transacted a shopping center or a land. And what I realized at that point of understanding that they're looking for the performance of money, I needed to understand how to structure the deals and how did other people do this. So I fly out to New York on an Inman Connect event where I spoke, and I spoke a little bit about the technology, what we were doing. And there was an asset manager in the crowd that was very impressed, and they approached us. And essentially at that point in time, they give us a project to manage, and they wanted us to provide full accounting into the project, full management, and really deliver this vision of the performance. So it was kind of my first opportunity, if you will, to manage an asset manager. And as I started getting into the accounting and understanding the structures and how they paid dividends and what the waterfall structure looked like and all these elements look like, I got probably the best university training you could ever get, right? It was live and you were paid for it. You couldn't beat that scenario. So essentially from there, we learned the ins and outs and how to structure these deals. And what was very surprising was the amount of wealth that these asset managers make. You know, the people on the ground, if you will, the realtor and the property manager make nothing compared to what these asset managers make. Granted, they're putting together the deal, they're putting together the business plan, they're ensuring that they can get the bank loans, they can bring their balance sheets. There's a lot of value that they add. But, you know, to behoove me in real estate, they've always taught me to transact, right? Sell, get a commission, let's keep going. You know, that's kind of what we're trained at. And at that point, the aha moment came, at least for me, which was stop thinking transactional and start thinking invitational. And these are two very big words that transferred the way I approach the business. And when you think about what I'm trying to say right now, when we talk about being invitational, you know, if you're invited to a party, the host controls everything, right? They serve you the dinner, they pick the drinks, they pick the location, and you're kind of going for that ride, right? And when I came up to my team and presented this, they were all kind of looking at me like I was crazy. Like, how are we ever going to invite somebody to an investment? Like, how does that actually work? And when I began connecting the dots of everything we learned with the asset manager, you realize that when you lock a property in, and you put a contract, you are the one that has the right to buy the property. And having that right has a lot of value, because now nobody can skip you. Nobody can go around you. You have the contract in place. So what you really need to get started is the deposit to lock in the property and lure in the seller to be in position. Now, the next part is capital, right? How do you fill in the capital? And the first time I did a deal, it was a nightmare. It was very scary. You thought to yourself, who's going to give you the money? How am I going to be able to put this together? And you're kind of running around really nervous in putting it together. Now that I look back, all I could tell you that great opportunities attract the money. It is unbelievable how easy it is to get capital in a deal when the deal is good. And that's where, you know, the magic, I think, of the real estate agent comes in, right? Because they're on the ground. They're on the battlefield. They understand every dynamics of the market. So ones that do, obviously not everybody does, but the ones that put that effort and time into it and figure out and be able to articulate where those opportunities are, in my opinion, are the ones that have the golden ticket. They just don't realize it because there's, in my opinion, there's no brokers that are really training on this. There's no education. I mean, we do have now several guys out there that are on social media that obviously push the knowledge of this, but what they're really pushing is not the knowledge. What they really want is for you to bring them the deal. That's basically what it all comes down to in terms of that. So anyhow, going to the capital side, I read a book and it's called Raising Capital for Real Estate. It's an excellent book. And this book basically broke down the communication and how to talk to the investor, Raising Capital for Real Estate. And the author is Hunter Thomas. And he really walks you down a path of how to get this done, right? And how to most importantly structure yourself. What is an LPGP structure? What are the documentations you need? How do you present to the investors? How do you build them up? There's an exception in the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is called the 506 exception. And in the book, for example, they break that down, the 506B, the 506C, what are the differences, how you lure and attract the investors. And technically, you're not creating a fund. You're creating a syndication for a deal purpose, which is allowed by the SEC for you to move on. So once I read that book and I understood that part, it was all about getting the attorneys and then going out and pitching to the investors. And what was very impressive was, as a realtor, I already knew how to sell to the investor because I was selling properties like we do all day long. So just, you know, really attracting the investor was super easy. Where you get nervous is actually telling them, okay, well, this is how we're going to divide the profits now. If we get by year five, this is what we do. And we performed above 15%. This is the return you're going to give us. And when you start getting into that part, you have to articulate your value very well. You have to articulate your ability to execute what it is the vision is going to be. A lot of times we just sell the vision and then we hand it off to the investor, and the investor is kind of taking your vision and running with it. Here, you're going to be the driver's seat of that vision, right? And when you understand the ability to do that, you can then start structuring. The other component I'll tell you about capital was that you have to get the loan. As the operator, you're going to go out and get the loan. So the first time we did this, we were very scared. We had no clue what we were worth. We had never had an accounting firm come in and study you and dissect you and figure out, you know, the value, right? So, you know, we were asking for an $8 million loan, I believe it was, for the first shopping center. And I'm like, is the bank really going to ever give us this money? And we're so used to, in the residential side, going through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and, you know, it's DTIs and it's your credit score. And it's just so different when you get into the mortgage side. The commercial mortgage side, we went through the process, you know, and we were literally crossing our fingers that we would get through this thing and get the loan approved. And what we realized is once we put our assets together, the companies, everything we had done, we actually had a pretty amazing balance sheet, which came to our surprise. And this is where I would tell you a lot of people get held back because they'll tell you, well, I don't have a balance sheet. I don't have that. Well, out there, there's investors that let you borrow their balance sheet for a percentage of your project. There's people that actually do this. They have a lot of capital. They'll be willing to sign a non-recourse loan, but you have to just obviously give them benefits within your project. You might give them 5%, 10%, 15%, 20% of what you're going to make as the operator of the project. So there's a lot of, you know, things out there you could do. Luckily for us, we were in the position between our private assets to be able to qualify for that loan. And we close up our first deal, we bring it into management, we start operating, and we realize that it's the same thing that we've always been doing. We just changed the philosophy from transacting and selling it to the investor and just walking away with a commission to now being completely part of the income producing or the wealth producing portions of the investment, right? And I'll put it to you this way, before we got into capital, we would make a commission selling the project. We would make a management fee for managing the project, and we would make rental income. We would get these three, basically, income streams into the company, which was nice, right? Because a lot of times a realtor is only getting the commission. And so when we expanded into the capital side, we started making money on the commission of the sale of the property, on the management, on the rental, an acquisition fee, a disposition fee once we sold the asset, a performance fee, and an asset management fee. So we literally doubled the income points and revenues for doing the same thing we've been doing for the last 20 years, right? So that was kind of that aha moment. And when we go through that first deal, we realize, wow, this is what we have to start focusing on and building a company that really does this, right? And that's where Avanti Way Capital kind of, you know, was born. And today, you know, we have 1,200 units coming up all across the state of Florida. We do developments. We have over 150,000 square feet of retail space right now. And we've moved. The last 2 years have been a bit slow, but I think now the market's shaping up where the commercial office space particularly is starting to show some very good deals. You're getting properties that are vacant 50%, but they're selling them at a 7 or 8% cap rate, right? So you're starting to see these deals that now begin to make sense. I think the commercial market, what we're seeing now is 2008. You know, which is you're going to regret not buying in the next, you know, year or so because you're picking up things so cheap. So that's kind of my story. And I guess to go a little bit further with what you said, Jennifer, and connect that dot, how do we analyze and how do we look at deals? If you're in the commercial market, you already know how to do this. People like you, Jennifer and Fernando, you guys are well-versed. You know how to put these deals together. For the residential agent like myself, it was a different story, right? You would put together very simple performances for buying a residential property. That's very easy. Taxes, maintenance, insurance, the income, here's the rental comps. It was very straightforward. The commercial deal becomes a lot more complex. There's less data, right? You need to know performance data. Luckily, I was in the management business and I would advise the realtor, get a good manager who knows what the hell they're doing. And most importantly, that knows what the hell they're doing, they have the same values as you. That's very important. They're looking to deliver the same experience that you are to that investor. And that should be your liaison aid to understand costs, because that's the biggest black hole. Rental comps on the commercial side are more difficult to get, but they're feasible to get. You can pick up the phone, call the landlords, you can go into CoStar, you can go to Kretzky, many different places to get some of the data. But we began putting together, you know, the performance of the assets. We consulted with a couple commercial people, and then we started building our criteria, right? Based on where we felt that we could manage and we could bring the most value as a company.
But it sounds to me that, interestingly, most syndicators will find the deal, find the capital, but then they have to build the infrastructure within which to manage, or they have to outsource that. You came at it from the infrastructure was already in place. The systems, the steps, and the actual where you really make the money is how well you manage that deal, to your point, right? And so you already had that. And so now you're only looking at two things, right? Supply and, you know, where your demand is going to be for the capital you're attracting, and the supply of deal flow that you're able to bring to those investors. Speak about that. How important are we're having the systems in place, or how important is to have systems in place when you are going to syndicate, or when you're going to be, you know, in the capacity of putting these deals together?
I think there's two types of realtors, call it out there, professionals, right? There's the generalist who's basically looking for an opportunity and just is transacting. And then there's the specialist, right? Whether they're focused in geographically or a geographical area, or they're focused in pre-construction, or they're focused in the investment realm, right? There's typically a specialization. I think the first thing you need to do, Fernando, is create your north. Is know where you want to go. What is it that you want to do? Where do you want to be? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? People, believe it or not, lack this. They do a business plan, and it's the new year's now, and we should all have our business plan, but our business plan is telling us the next 12 months. Where's my strategic plan that I can show 10 years from now, what am I doing? And I learned very early on that you need to stop betting on tomorrow and start betting in the next 5 years. Right? Because the money I'm making today, Fernando, is not what I planned 6 months ago or a year ago. It's what I planned 5 years ago. right? And what I'm planning today, it's going to pay me off in another 5 years. So that long-term vision gave me the ability to understand I wanted to be a player in the investment market to bring value. I had no clue how I was going to get there. I did not have a roadmap. And FYI, I did not have a mentor. Although my family was in the real estate business, you know, my mother got to a certain level. And in order for us to break through, I couldn't copy what she did, right? I had to really think outside the box. I had to crash on my own, fail on my own, get back up on my own. Because in those lessons that a lot of people try to avoid in life, it's really the learning lesson, right? When you live it and you went through that scenario, you're going to carry with you a vision and a horizon, if you will, that will get you there. So if you want to be in the capital markets and that size, you have to plant that flag. This is where I'm going. That's step one. Then step two is, how do you build an infrastructure that begins to add value? We live in a business where we have to invest very little money, right? It's usually our time and energy is what we're investing in trade for that money. So, you know, you start saying, okay, I want to do investments. I got into the residential side because it's what I knew what to do. I knew how to rent the properties. I knew where the good condominiums were. I knew what was worth buying and what wasn't worth buying. And so I kind of stepped into it that way. And again, zero background. Like, I'm talking zero financial background. I don't have a master's degree in real estate. I don't have anything of that nature, but I had the desire and I knew that that was my north and I would figure it out. You have to be very humble. That's another one that's key, right? When you set that north, start reading, start learning. You realize over time that what you really need to do is ask the right question. It's not about asking questions. It's about asking the right questions. And you will find the solutions. You will find the answers. And you will find those people that share information with you when you show you have that desire to grow and grow into it, right? So I think ultimately that led me to start building that infrastructure slowly. The sales side, then got into the management side, then built that up and built a unique experience in the management side. And then the next thing I knew, it's like what you were saying, it was almost magic. You look back and you're like, wow, I have the infrastructure. I've operated these buildings. I know what I'm doing. I know how to structure these deals. And essentially, you know, we had built a gold mine. And I share this with Jennifer, at least a lot. You know, all these ventures are like climbing a mountain. As you start at the beginning, you're walking with your 2 feet. When you get to the top, you're using your hands, you're using rope. I mean, you're doing all these things. But as you start climbing this mountain, the vision, the horizon becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And you understand where you could play a game, and everything you've learned on the way up that mountain is what's going to get you to the top if you know how to use it correctly. And that's kind of my insight on structuring that. And there's many ways to go about it. Nowadays, you can join a team, right? You could join an organization that has that ecosystem built for you. You could accelerate that growth with joining a mentor, partnering up with another syndicator. There's a lot of syndicators that love partnerships. We love them too when the value is there. We hate them when the value is not there. We don't want that. And most importantly, you want to surround yourself with people that you're going to have fun. This is what we do all day long, right? And having fun is key. Being with smart people that can solve problems, that are not scared of problems, that are willing, you know, to fail. I'll give you the flip side of that. I usually find my partners to be the people that I want in the room when I fail, right? That to me is the most critical part, because success we're all going to enjoy. But when we're failing and we're willing to, you know, stand side by side and figure this out and push forward, those are the people that you need around you. And that's how you need to, you know, pick those people, if you will.
So let me go to that in your invitation comment. And because I like that, I like how you compared it to a party and you're the host and a lot of the words, I guess, because I'm still in party mode from the holiday seasons. But I'm
you're
thinking,
always in party mode.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, exactly.
So who do you decide? Do you always invite the same people? Are your invitations curated based on the deal? Do those guests that you invite have some of the knowledge that you lack? Can you tell me a little bit about how you curate your guest list?
Okay, so we'll get a little bit technical on this just to put some context into it. You have two types of syndications that you put together, the 506B and the 506C. right? The difference between one and the other is that the 506C lets what's called a sophisticated investor in, and a sophisticated investor would be qualified as a realtor, but doesn't have a lot of assets. Why would a realtor qualify? Is because they're in the industry, they're practitioners, they know what they're doing, right? So they have some form or knowledge, and you could invite a certain amount of them. There's a limited amount, I believe it's 35 off the top of my head right now, that you can invite. And then everybody else has to be an accredited investor. An accredited investor is basically a person that has the assets and the wealth to make a decision on its own and how to invest. Essentially, the government, what they don't want is for you to grab the grandmother, la abuelita, like we would say here in Miami, that only has, you know, $200,000, and we took her money and then we lost it, and the poor lady's out in the street, right? So the government doesn't want us, you know, managing that type of money, right? They want us to have people that invest, they have money, they have the wealth, they know that they can lose, they know that they can win. So depending on how you pick and which one you're going about is how you're going to curate and know what you're going to attract. The beauty of about the 506B, and I don't like to use it this much, a lot of my competitors do, the 506B is you're self-verifying yourself, right? So you're basically signing an affidavit saying, yeah, I'm this person, I have this much money, and yada yada, right? What ends up happening is, you know, the reality is most people don't read all the documents. That's just the nature of the beast. The investor is going to pick you because you gave them a sense of trust. You're a professional. You believe in your name. You built a reputation. These are the major things why anybody's going to give you money anyhow, right? You're going to have those investors that are going to send all the documents to the attorneys and read them through. But a lot of the times what people do with these 506Bs is that they're just putting a form in there saying that you're accredited and you signed it. And then they blame you for kind of lying to them if something goes wrong, right? Now, the downfall of the 506B, although you have that self verification, which is positive, is that you cannot sell that person the first time you meet them. There's a delayed amount of time that has to happen. Some people use 15 days, other people use 30 days, other people use a year of when you met that contact and you're able to close them. So Cardone, which is a competitor, right? We all, I think, know him out there. What does he do? He invites you to events and he builds a database. And now he has a way to communicate back to his investors and try to get money from them because he's already known them, quote unquote, for more than 30 days, right? And so now, you know, you start building your database and your structure if you're going to go that route. The 506C only allows accredited investors and they cannot be self-verified. They have to be third-party verified. So now you're adding a level of complexity that the investor you're really getting is really a serious investor. An accountant has to kind of give you a letter, an attorney, a bank. You need to make sure that this person's third-party verified. But the beauty of the 506 is that it lets me market my project and I can transact immediately after meeting the investor. This is my favorite part because as you're expanding and you're building these databases and you're building your reputation and you're moving through these projects, you want to have that flexibility, right? You're going to meet investors that really like what you're doing, that really connect with you, and they want to invest with you there. So you got to pick first how your infrastructure is going to be, and then you're moving towards what you attract. The other part I'd tell you on that is that, you know, you have investors that have high risk profiles. They're in a different age. Right in their life, they might be in the young 30s, they inherited a lot of money, they're willing to gamble more, they're looking more for the larger returns. These are typically the ones we'll find going into our development projects, which give a higher return, but there's higher risk, right? And then you have maybe an older profile where they're looking for cash on cash, they're looking for monthly cash flows that are coming in, and they're going to invest, you know, into your income producing projects that you're finding. So you got to figure out where you're going, what type of income you're going to be producing or what type of wealth, and then who are the people that are going to attract to that. And then you're kind of building your database and you're building your infrastructure, if you will, based on that.
So along those lines, I find that really interesting because you just described me earlier on, right? When I was younger and now, right? So now I don't invest in development properties, but I'm curious. So you have several properties that are under construction. Do you ever keep a property but change the ownership? So you would take it now from a construction company with the young bucks to the older bucks, and put that into now, I guess, an invitation list of people who want the cash on cash. And if so, how do you structure something like that? Because now you're keeping the asset maybe a little bit longer. So maybe instead of a 5 year out, it's a 10 year.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I definitely share that vision of creating that, connecting the dots, because the longer we can manage and the longer we can stay in the game with a great asset, you know, the better we're going to do. And the appetite starts changing where you're at every structure. Just like you said, you know, I'll walk you through a deal really quick. The first thing we do is we buy a land, right? And we're in the process of entitling the land, and we're trying to change the variance, and we're trying to do many things to accomplish what the final goal is, right? At that point in time, that's the highest amount of risk that you can get in the investment, right? That's ground zero. If things fail, we're going to lose. You typically don't lose your money. You'll sell the land, but you might lose some money, or you made very little money and you wasted a bunch of time. And that's one type of investor that comes into the picture. Then when everything's entitled and ready to go, you go and you're going to raise, you know, different type of money. Now the risk profile changes because there's less risk, and we start building out the property. And the first investors might get completely bought out by the second investors, or the first investors might stay on, and then we're plugging in the second investors to layer up whatever is needed to get to that next stage. And then you have the completion, right? Once you've completed the project, let's say it's a retail center, at that point, somebody's going to, obviously the risk profile is even less because now it's all done. There's no risk here. Now we're just renting. We're deriving the income of it. And so that's one type of investor that might come in and clean up the other investors that you had. And then last but not least is when the asset's performing. Right? When it's stabilized and ready to go, you might go ahead and do that again. Now, although that does happen and you want to stay long-term, a lot of the times, once you're done and you're stabilized, you're refinancing the project, you're getting all the money back to the investors. And FYI, there's zero taxation on that.
Right, cash out refi.
Because it's a loan. Mm-hmm. It's a cash out refi. And I'm typically giving the investor, you know, 75 to 100% of the money that they gave us. And now all of a sudden they're sitting with an infinite return because the project takes care of itself, pays the loan, you've gotten paid back, and you're making, on top of that, you're getting a cash on cash dividends annually based on the performance of the property. And it's a beautiful deal. Now, at some point, you as an operator might go through a process called crystallization. So when you develop and you're holding a project in the long run, As a GP, as a general partner, the operator of the project, the promoter, if you will, you're essentially, you know, you've done all this work. You're essentially not able to get paid till you sell the project 8 or 9 years down the road, if that's the projection that you did. So what you end up doing is crystallizing the project by year 3 or 4. Once it's stabilized, it's almost like, all right, I performed, I did this. Here we go. We'll continue to manage the ongoing concerns in the building. We'll continue to do the property management, but you essentially get paid out. Because as the operator, when you first start, what you need is capital. Capital keeps you in the game. You need to cycle through that capital, and you need to move them so that you're able to now play the next game and then, you know, build your empire, if you will.
That's very interesting. You know, one of the things that I hear you speak, and I know how tech forward you are, and Jennifer and I always revel in your engineering mindset, which is really at the heart of it, a problem solver, right? But I do want to ask you, the majority of the comments that you have made have really been about mindset. And so I'd love for you to speak a little bit about that, because, you know, sometimes we get very bogged down or even limited in the idea that, well, I don't know how to do this, or I don't know how to do that, or I don't have this tech or that tech. And it all always looks like an obstacle. But, you know, we often say, you know, the obstacle is the way. Sometimes going through it, it's what's going to get you to the other side. How important is that has been on putting all these deals together?
Huge. Huge. I teach my kids four major things that I'll share with you guys here. Number one, never give up, right? Never, ever, ever give up, period. you're going to fail. You're going to drop. Some drops are going to hurt you more than others. The more they hurt, the more you learned. The next thing, and this comes to what you just asked, is make the best of what you have. We're all at different stages of our lives, right? And if we start trying to compete against Elon Musk tomorrow, I mean, you're not going to compete. You're going to come up with every excuse of why you can't do it. And also, when you learn to compete against yourself, it's really where you start growing, right? I used to worry about competition. Now I could, excuse my French, give a fuck about competition. I'm just out there. I'm doing my thing. I'm looking at where I could improve and what I can do better. And I think that I grew up in a world where scarcity was a reality, right? My parents lost everything in Nicaragua. They were very, very well off. So, you know, the shift in their lives was pretty drastic. And I found my father always making the best of what he had. That was kind of the environment that we had to grow up with. And he had a very strong entrepreneurial mindset. Rest his soul now, but I learned a lot from him. I mean, he would stay up late and he would make me study in the office. And while he was working on something, he was making a, you know, property management program in DOS with a American guy that he found in Radio Shack. And they didn't even, he didn't speak Spanish and my dad didn't speak English, but they figured out how the hell to do it, which was that drive, right? And I remember at one point seeing one of my brothers come into the family business and was always complaining. Oh, we don't have the server. We don't have the best Windows. We can't do the, it was all about limitation for him, right? And I promised myself there after viewing that, like I would never do that. You know, so when I got into the business, I had zero money. In fact, the business owed $80,000, and in a year, if we didn't pay that back, we were going to be closed down. And you know, you have a mother who's in her high 50s already, going to retire pretty soon. And I need to solve the problem. And how the hell do I get this lady to not worry about her retirement and be able to successfully, you know, retire? Which, thank God, till today I have delivered my promise. No, but essentially, you know, I built a computer. I would do everything that I need to do. I didn't have programmers. I'm an engineer. Right? That's what I studied. So I used that to my benefit. Right. I started building the softwares that we now have, you know, myself, ground up. And getting in credit card debt and didn't care if it was a 20% interest because I knew I was going to bring more than 20% back to the table, right? A lot of people get stuck on, oh my God, what is it going to cost me? And this is too much. And, you know, maybe your idea is too small then. That's basically it, right? Flip it around. If it's big enough, it's going to pay more than 20%. So I didn't mind, you know, pushing the credit card and obviously being wise, knowing that I would deliver. It was key. And all along the way, and every stage that you're at in life, and as you're climbing, call it this mountain, you have what you have. You're given the cards that you're given based on how you've walked your path, what you've learned in your path, and it's up to you to use them and value them. So I think that that's a very important thing. And we all start small. Everyone, you know, including Jeff Bezos, he was in a garage packaging up, you know, boxes and sending out books at the beginning, right? And we all have to dream big. I think that's important. The third one is, you know, do it with love and passion, right? Like you got to love what you're doing, right? You get out of bed every day. Something's got to freaking drive you. And it's not money, because you get to the point where you make the money. What else are you going to do, right? Luckily for us, we've gotten to the point where money's no longer a big deal for us. We know how to make it. We know how to produce it. And if my drive were for money, I would have quit already and I'd be bored at home. And that's, I think we all are here to give back to our communities, play a big role in our communities, right? And that sense of giving and sharing and creating wealth together, right? It's fun. It's amazing. It keeps us going, which I think is, you know, very, very important in those three factors that I just shared with you.
I love it. So what's the fourth?
So the fourth one is be grateful. That's basically it, right? Every day, wake up and thank God. I'm pretty religious with my family. I have a strong belief in faith. I always invite everybody to have a belief in some sort of faith. It doesn't have to be a religion, but you know that something's bigger than you out there and something's giving you a gift, right? And whatever that gift looks like for each one of us, you know, take advantage of it. It's your job to deploy that and use that to the world, you know? Mine is maybe creating relationships, gathering the right people around, bringing the tech sense to it and upgrading the experience for people. And you know, that's maybe a gift that I have that I use very well, and I try to use it all the time, right? But it is a waste to have a gift and just simply not use it and take it for granted. You see a lot of kids now, I have three kids, and you see them growing up, and we've provided a very different environment, all of us in the world. The world has only gotten better. So you had no choice but to provide a different, more stable environment than what our parents went through, which went through the Great Depression and our grandparents, and there was a lot more chaos, right? So the type of human being you bring up nowadays, it's almost like they take for granted all these things, right? And I try to always tell my kid, you know, be grateful. Every day we drive to school, I drop them off. There's a church next to us. So I always, you know, tell them, hey, make a quick prayer and be thankful. Be thankful that you got one more day in this place. Be thankful that you could help somebody else out. Be thankful that you can create and make this place a better place. And I think that that's the fourth biggest driver in that pillar.
That's great. We talk about gratitude a lot. And I love that you brought up your like superpowers being relationships, because I actually wrote down in preparation for the interview is that you are very data driven and all of the companies are very data driven, but you're grounded by relationships. So I definitely see that in you. And we talk about that all the time, that even though data is super important, and the more micro you can get with it in our business, it really is all about relationships. And to your point, yeah, you know, life's too short to spend it with people you don't like, don't respect, or that makes you that zap your energy or stress you out. And I think we all need to remember that in the real estate business, that, and I think that might be the difference too, when you're only transactional, you're so worried about the deal that you might be doing deals that are potentially big, but are sucking you dry, are making you miserable, or stressing you out, or keeping you up at night, and costing you
far more than you think.
Exactly, on the other side, because.
Sorry to interrupt, but I want to ask you a question that I think would be beneficial for those that are that listen to the podcast, which is that I think we can agree that the most difficult part, now that you have the infrastructure, you know where to find the capital, you already have a proven record, that, you know, inevitably the biggest issue is to find the right deals, right? Because that's really what's going to make everything work. And the sourcing of the deals becomes, you know, a big component of the future growth for any capital company. You also then, because of your success and your ability to do this, get pitched a lot of deals. And we have a lot of brokers out there that listen to this, and our own brokers. What would you give as a guide or some tips on what would you like to hear from a broker when they want to bring a deal to you for your consideration?
That's a great question, because I think that this is, you know, all the GP operators are probably going to agree with me on this. We get bombarded, right? And there's a lot of crap out there. Just, you know, realtors are just throwing Hail Marys. They don't know what they're doing, you know. But some of those Hail Marys actually land, believe it or not. Some of them are touchdowns. And the question to yourself is always, how do I set up the radar where I don't miss this? And I think that the way I view this is that there's two approaches. You have the opportunistic approach, which is, you know, the investor that's just looking for an opportunity. And if it's a right opportunity, he's going to go at it. And then you have the strategic approach, which is a more well thought out thing, saying, listen, I'm going into the retail sector. Here's why I'm going into this. This is the type of retail centers that I'm looking for. And what you're actually doing is refining what it is. And yes, there might be a great opportunity in Miami Beach to buy a waterfront property, but that's not what I do, right? So I take more of the strategic, but there are GPs out there that will structure things based on the opportunity. Right. I think that the ones that do that work very hard, because every deal requires an immense amount of understanding, depth, numbers, market demands. So imagine looking at every type of opportunity, you go crazy. So as I started in this, I had limited resources. So I definitely had to think strategic, not because I wanted to, it's because I had to. But, you know, now I kind of continue to work that way. Although we now have, you know, a complete underwriting team, right? That's underwriting deals. And you know, we have, I think it's four or five people So our ability to underwrite now is very different than before. So now you might venture off to saying, okay, well, let's see if there's other markets that we can go into. We have the manpower to do that. But I would tell you, if you were starting or thinking of getting into this, just master an area. When I was selling residential as, let's say, investments, I picked the north point of Doral all the way down to Kendall on 88th Street. I was on 836 on one side and then going all the way. At that time, it was just a turnpike. Well, I guess a little bit further west in the turnpike in some areas. And I was just focused in that market. And I mastered every condominium. I knew which ones had the right bylaws, which ones were investment friendly, which ones had parking for the tenants. And essentially, it was very easy for me to start selling investors there because I knew what I was doing. You know, now in retail centers, I have a very diverse background of what I look for. You know, we're looking for the necessity-based shopping centers that are going to be the mom-and-pop stores that really, really tie in the community. Your barber shops, your dry cleaner, your little restaurant that feeds that community. Those are the types of places we look there. And then in residential, you know, anything that's necessity-based in the sense of middle-class, lower-middle-class projects, we love those types of projects. So we try to stick on that to that and we do an investment seminar every year where we come up with the strategies. We have a committee. We get everything approved and we kind of have the vision for the year to do that. But it all depends on your situation. As realtors, we come across a lot of deals. So I could understand why some of them would be opportunistic. But make sure that deal is big enough where you're going to be able to get the right people. The right wealth is going to be built for everybody. And you can move it forward.
That's awesome. But when people are pitching you deals, what is it that you don't want to hear or what is it that you want to hear? Because what I find is that how many times things are pitched to you, but the person that is pitching it doesn't really understand the dynamics of the deal, right? And so, you know, and I kind of want to jump into that because how much of an influence that has on you having a willingness to look at the deal and to take the time and investment to look at the dynamics of it.
Yeah. So again, using kind of that framework I gave you, right? If it falls within our strategy, listen, the numbers that realtors will typically give you and the owners, they're not telling you the truth. We have to be clear. They're dressing up, you know, the deal right so that it could have the attraction for you, right? It's your job as an underwriter or as your team to really get the deal and then plug your own numbers. How do I perform? How have I worked on a building like this? What has been the historical here? You know, you have Trepid now, which gives you a great immense amount of data that you can get for buildings where you could look at, you know, past performance. And then you're kind of building back up your storyline, if you will. It's almost like you have to redo the pitch.
I think what Fernando's looking for is you, like, so what advice would you give a broker? What information should a broker have to present a deal in a way that a GP would take a look at it? I know GPs are different, but in general. So you're saying you get pitched, there's a lot of garbage. What is the broker's...
Right. And I think one of the items that you've mentioned is, well, you got to know who your audience is. So as if I'm pitching to you, I have to understand what is your criteria and what is in your wheelhouse.
Right.
There you go. That's what I was going to, you know, allude to. It's listen to what the GP is looking for and give them particularly that, right? Don't just Hail Mary all these deals over and see what sticks to the wall, right? It, curate your audience like you're saying. Fernando is exactly right. And again, you know, the pitch decks that exist, the materials that we get is great, but a lot of it is fluff. So it's not trustworthy. So a lot of people focus a lot on the pitch and, you know, this and that. The operator is going to get that deal and run with the vision, right? Now, if you as a realtor have the vision and how this needs to be driven to give you the outcome that you're looking for, then focus on that, you know, bring that to light on your pitch deck because now you're bringing value. Maybe the operator says, hey, Fernando, you know what? I need to keep you on this deal. Like if you you got a clear path on how to get this done to me. So I think, you know, if you would add a lot of that would be great. And again, listen to each GP. They're all going to be different. They all require different necessities, if you will. And focus in on that. Don't burn your bridges by just sending garbage to anybody. And FYI, garbage can be gold for someone else, right? So you could have a great deal, you send it to me, but that's not what I'm looking for. And I tell you no, and you know, you missed the opportunity to send it to Fernando, who would have loved the deal, right? And it was gold for Fernando. So definitely you wanna understand your audience.
No doubt. And I know we're getting to the end here, but Enrique, I often have this conversation with people. You are well-read. You definitely have to process a lot of data in not only your professional life, but really we get bombarded with data points from all over the place. So I'm wondering if you could speak to how do you process, how do you consume data? How do you consume information? Because obviously we all have 24 hours in the day, right? You got three kids, as you mentioned, you got a busy personal and professional life. And so I think a big part of what I'm noticing with the professionals that we work with and the people that we help guide is that they have a difficult time processing, you know, the enormous amount of information that is at their behest.
Yeah, look, that's a great question. And there's two things that I would bring to light. And one of them you actually taught me, Fernando, believe it or not, and how we're gonna mix this together. But essentially, you know, I try to look at things in a very logical way. I took a logic class in college, and it was the if, and really as an engineer, as a programmer, if you will, you're taught to think of all the possibilities that can go wrong from A to Z while you program. Programming is not just putting two cents of codes of how you get to where you're getting to. It's really figuring out all the problems that you're going to have and how do you block those problems. So that gave me an ability to think through things. And then I realized one day when you were presenting as chair and you did your Formula One presentation, which was amazing, I talked to you after. I'm like, how do you come up with these things? And you told me it's a story. So what you're really doing is putting a story together. And so using logic, it kind of connected in that point in time for me. I mean, I've never talked to you about it, but it connected to me at that point in time to say, wow, you know, as you look at these deals, you're creating the story with logic. And these two things have to meet together so that it makes sense and the story can be sold and the story can be something that we can convert to being real or not. Now, the way I approach these things is that I will build a story and I'll be very creative. I'll be free, right? And sometimes a story is very crazy, right? It doesn't look very real. And then you sit back and you say, can you bring this to life? Is this really a reality that I can put together? Because when you're developing, you're getting an area that something doesn't even exist. The price per square foot has never been achieved that you're going to achieve. So you guess what? You better have a hell of a story, right? You better have a hell of a future. And so that's kind of what you're putting together as you're analyzing these deals. And it becomes fun. It becomes almost like you're reading a book, right? Where okay, you're starting to think, you're being creative. And, you know, you have to be effective at creating these stories. At the beginning, it's going to take you a week. And then it's going to take you 3 days. And then it's going to take you 2 days. And it's like writing. It's like running. It's like anything you're going to do. The more you do it, the quicker you're able to interpret. And then the quicker you're able to see these stories and put them together. Does that make sense to you? I know that's probably very untraditional, what you'll hear from a GP side, it's a different angle, but it's the truth, right? It's what works.
Well, and that's what people can relate to. They can relate more to a story and a vision than they can if you do the numbers and the breakdown. Plus, the story and the vision is more exciting than the numbers.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to get into the emotional intelligence, right? And people buy stories.
Correct. Absolutely. All righty. Anything else since you've been pumping?
Listen, I mean, we could do this for another hour, you know.
We're just warming
there's a
up,
reason why we're up. There's a reason why we're partners, because we can spend all day just shooting the breeze. But no, thank you, Enrique, very much. I think this is very educational, very helpful. There's definitely a lot of good information in regards to not only how to structure a deal and put it together, but also how to work with people that are putting these deals together, right? Because, you know, a lot of our audience is still transactional, right? And they're trying to elevate themselves and they're trying to look for ways in which to be part of the deal, right? And so I think you provided a lot of good information. How about you, partner? Do you have an interesting stat?
No, because right. I think it might be outdated. I had the transaction volume for capital being at $5 billion, but I think that's an old number. Do you know what Avanti Capital's transaction volume is to date?
You're talking about the Avanti Group, the entire group?
Yeah.
I think we roughly probably did about 1.8 billion in sales.
1.8 just for the year.
Just for the year.
Not overall.
Oh, no, yeah, yeah. No, no, yeah. Overall. Yeah, yeah,
I'm doing transaction volume overall. You have 5 billion on the site, but I know, I mean, I've been seeing that number for several years, and I know you've done a lot.
Yeah, that number is definitely, no. The total amount, we're definitely probably at 7 or 8 billion at this point. I mean, and now we're almost hitting 2 billion every year now. So,
amazing.
Exactly.
Right.
But listen,
the stat that I wanted to
I appreciate. You know, being here with you guys, thank you so much for really considering me out there. And my take for the industry is, listen, be with people that are creating an impact, right? Be with people that can add value, that you guys can multiply together and have the right ecosystem. And I think this word is key in our industry, because there's great brokers that specialize in certain things, but that's all they do. And they don't have kind of an ecosystem where your growth path can be, you know, achieved. There are other brokers that have great ecosystems. That's what I allude to, is really pick that right place. And if you're not growing and you're not being pushed in the environment that you're at, you know, rethink it. We're just starting the year. We did our business plans. We're all excited. Maybe this podcast gave you some ideas to say, wow, my north is going to be the investment realm. And then ask yourself, what do you need to get out there? I think that's what do you need to get there, right? And who are the people that you want to, you know, surround yourself that are going to push you up there. I think those are the key takeaways. We're in an incredible industry, lots of changes, lots of opportunities with these changes that have come about. And I think as the industry moves on, we're going to be pushed to specialize, to really bring immense amount of value to the consumers. So I think we need to focus on that in the upcoming years.
Fantastic.
Great way to end. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We hope you have a tremendous 2025. Thank you for always pulling up a chair. We're coming up on our 100th episode, which we're extremely excited about. And we really appreciate the support. Thank you, Enrique. Thank you, partner.
Oh my gosh, year three. We're starting year three.
That's, I know.
Time flies.
Here's to 2025. I love it.
Take
All right,
care,
God
everyone.
Bless you
Bye-bye.
Guys.
Bye-bye.